Was Michael Garson sure? It's S-H, as if it would be U-R, but it's E-R.
Right.
And sometimes he goes by Michael, sometimes Mike, sometimes Garson, sometimes a.k.a. Tom Mahoney.
Yeah.
Tom Mahoney, and we may get into that later. But this is Paul Rodell and IBS Oral History Project. Today is August 24th. Michael Schur, or Garson Schur, that's him, was in Vietnam 1966 through 68. So, like many people, he was in that big buildup of IVS, was there when the resignations and the Johnson letter was around, was there during the Tet Offensive, etc., etc. So there's ample ground to cover in the background. But first, I did mention before starting the tape that we'd like to know something of the background to each of the individuals we interviewed, and that was not part of the form. So, where and when born? Raised by, you know, your parents, what were they like, or maybe a foster parents or whatever. What were the influences on your life, on your development as a young kid, that set you up, in a sense, to become interested in IVS whenever you heard about it?
Okay, I was born in Minneapolis, raised in St. Paul.
I didn't realize you were hometown.
Oh, yeah.
Because we are sitting, by the way, in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. Are we in Minneapolis now or St. Paul?
No, we're in Minneapolis.
Oh, okay.
And for people who live here, especially my age, there's a great distinction.
Uh-huh.
So I'm a St. Paul person.
Okay.
When I pick up a newspaper, I pick up the St. Paul paper.
Ooh.
And although I've been living in this place for 7 years now, I consider it temporary. Mm-hmm. The two cities, different characteristics.
Okay.
So,
well,
but I'm a local.
In Chicago, there's the north side and the south
okay,
side.
Okay, there you go.
And I would never be called a Southsider.
There you go.
I will always be called a Cubs fan. And the White Sox, I don't follow the minor league. So,
there you go.
But anyway, so you were born here.
Yeah.
When was that?
1943.
Okay.
We moved to St. Paul about 1944. Uh-huh. My father was in the Army. He was at Fort Snelling.
Uh huh.
So, which is nearby. Went to public schools in St. Paul, and I don't know about any formative influence. You asked about my parents.
Yeah, what they did. Let me put this down. Obviously, your dad was in the Army at some point.
He was in the Army and remained in government service. He was a naturalization examiner for the federal government. He was a civil servant.
Yeah.
My mother was a full-time housewife.
Uh-huh.
Had one brother, younger by 4 years. The formative influence, the connection with IVS, that came later. I went away to college.
But there are different parts of influence that create you as a person and as a character, and your basic beliefs and interests and things like that.
I can't tell you about that because my brother and I were not heavily influenced by our parents.
Uh-huh. Scouting, church, school, you know, those kinds of things.
As I look back, I find it, Paul, difficult to trace such influences.
Okay.
I'm not arrogant enough to think that we are both self-created men.
Mm-hmm.
We're influenced by everything around us. But there wasn't so much influence in the home. Part of it was because my parents' marriage was a very unhappy one. And it was very unhappy before we came along.
Mm.
And as a result, there was a resentment on the part of my mother against my father becoming close with either of the children. And, you know, as I look back, and this is something my brother and I sorted out years later, wedges were driven between us as well. And it was only when we became adults that we were able to form a relationship. There were 4 years, we were 4 years apart.
Yeah.
And that's pretty big when you're a little kid.
Yeah.
And I had gone away to college, so only later as adults were we able to form a relationship and try to piece together what had gone on. So the home was not a very happy place, and we spent as little time there as possible.
Yeah.
Both of us. So formative influence, I don't think, was there. A combination of values that we acquired in school, in religious school, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of thing that's gone out of style in America, because God forbid you should mention anything that's remotely connected with religion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's had good aspects and bad aspects, but I think we benefited from growing up in the 50s.
And in a religious school? Is that what you're saying?
Well, we didn't go to a parochial school.
Uh-huh.
We're Jewish. Uh-huh. There was Hebrew school that we went to after school, to our great resentment. 3:30,
yeah,
other kids
right.
got to play. We
and
had
you got to go back to the books.
Oh, yeah. 4 weekdays a week and Sunday. And that school was pretty chaotic. I think there were, you know, some values seep through.
Of course.
But it's hard to trace, for me,
yeah.
to trace back what it was. But I think, for example, our political viewpoint, which for both of us was quite left to center, was not something we acquired from our parents, because they never talked about such things. We were forced to make these choices much more on our own than most kids were. You know, most kids, in my experience, their outlook on life and their politics, and the two are linked, are either exactly what their parents' outlook is, or exactly the opposite. Okay? And ours wasn't. And ours...
Because you didn't know where your parents were on the political spectrum.
Vaguely. There was also another aspect to this that comes to mind. I remember one time I went to the state fair.
Mm-hmm.
State fair is happening this week. This is
perhaps
why it comes
to
mind. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I used to go around and sign up for every free thing you could. And free literature and a chance on the Encyclopedia Britannica. If they pull your name, you get all 26 volumes, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And one day a nice lady appeared with an armful of literature. I think she was a little disappointed to find out that I was about 14.
She probably was.
Yeah, that didn't stop her, and she wanted to...
didn't stop you either.
Yeah, and she introduced herself to whoever answered the door as so-and-so had come to see me from the Socialist Workers' Party. And in the front of the house was a little alcove. This is a place where there was a closet you could hang your coat, and there was a little bench you could sit down on and pull off your boots in the winter.
Yeah.
And that led into the living room. And the lady was asked to sit down, and I was fetched. And I sat in that alcove with her while she described to me all the wonderful things that the Socialist Workers' Party did and all this literature. And that left a great impression upon me, because she was not invited into the parlor.
Mm-hmm.
This is gross rudeness. I never saw anything like this on the part of my parents. But my father worked for the federal government.
Uh-huh.
And, well, when I was was 14, that would have been 56? Six.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was not long after McCarthy was really riding high.
Yeah.
Actually, it was a year or two after the Army McCarthy hearings.
Yeah.
And
about more closer to a year than two.
Yeah, and I remember afterwards I was told I should be more careful about who I have come up to the house.
Actually, yeah, your dad had reason to be scared.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, his ultimate boss was an army buddy of Eisenhower's, sure.
Yeah, no matter what his political views, mm-hmm. whether he was Democrat or Republican, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. So, I mean, they were people who went and voted for Adlai Stevenson twice and never talked about it in the House.
Mm-hmm.
I would say our outlook on life, and in particular our politics, were things that we developed on our own because we had very little goosing in one direction or another. And because of that, we've probably been more flexible than most people our age.
Mm-hmm.
As far as IBS is concerned, I can tell you exactly why I thought of IBS. I remember this very well. At that time, I was living in New Haven.
Mm-hmm.
I had just entered graduate school at Yale.
Mm-hmm. Where was the undergrad?
At Yale also.
At Yale also, okay.
Mm-hmm. And and I got together with three other guys, and we rented a house
mm-hmm.
and shared it. And one of those guys is a fellow named Doug Marvey. He came from St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
He was a little older than I, but I knew his sister, I knew his little brother, and that's how we got together. And he was also starting off in this in the economics program at Yale. And we found two other guys, we rented a house. And every Saturday morning, Doug would be walking out the door carrying some sign going off to protest the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. This would have been what year?
This is now the fall of 1965.
65, okay.
Things are beginning to heat up. And I was pretty much, when I was in college, I was pretty much lost in schoolwork.
Yeah.
Which I found very difficult. And I was a scholarship boy, and mm-hmm. I knew that I had to do well if I were going to be able to continue this life of indolence. And so...
Well, especially at a place like Yale, it's pretty expensive if you don't have scholarships.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes.
I don't know what your family did as far as money, but it would have been a very steep bite.
Well, God bless the National Merit Scholarship Corporation, because uh-huh. I got that plus working part-time covered it.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, at least not Yale.
Yeah. So it was... when other guys were partying, I was studying.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a pretty well ingrained habit. So I was pretty oblivious to what was going on. Except, here's Doug walking out of the door.
With his sign.
The sign. And this is what got me interested. And Sterling Memorial Library is a huge library. There was no shortage of information on Vietnam. Once you figured out it was all listed under Annam for some strange reason. And I started reading, because
I know the name of the person who probably was responsible for that.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's changed. It's no longer the pacified South, that's for sure. And, you know, very quickly, I noticed that if you went to, shall we say, sources of contemporary information,
uh-huh.
there were two stories that had nothing in common with each other. And so I started digging in the library to find out what's the background of all of this. And very quickly, this became a great deal more interesting than economic theory.
Uh-oh. Grades in trouble.
Well, grades weren't in trouble, but they would have been. And I was reading all this stuff about Vietnam, and stimulated by Doug's interest. Footnote, what this led to was I decided that I wanted to go over with IBS. I heard about IBS because there was somebody from my hometown who had been in it.
Oh, who was that?
Okay. Bobby Levy.
Mm-hmm. Was he what country?
I don't even recall.
Okay.
But there was some connection there. And the, and it clicked when I heard some reference to IBS somewhere, and I contacted IBS.
Let me see if he was either Laos or Vietnam. L-E-V...
L-E-V-Y.
L-E-V-Y. Okay.
Yeah.
You can continue. I'll just...
Okay. The footnote is that Doug, who was a very promising student, left during that first year, not long after I did. And acquired some notoriety later. He was one of the Milwaukee 14. I got very interested in Vietnam, and I would like to say I was motivated by humanitarianism, but I think it was more curiosity. I wanted to find out which of these stories explain what was going on. And I figured that from what I understood of what IBS was doing, it's like the old joke, which is too scatological to go on this tape, but I might not help, but I wouldn't hurt.
Yeah.
And I'd find out.
Yeah. Just to tell you, there was a Robert Levy, L-E-V-E-Y.
Well, he knows how to spell his name better than I do.
But the year is wrong. Because this particular Robert Levy was in Vietnam 65, 67.
That would make sense, because I was there 66 through 68.
But I thought this guy was already had been a volunteer.
No, I had heard that he...
was going to go into it.
He was, well, let me see, in the fall of 1965, he would have gone over already.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't talk to him. I just heard the name.
Oh, you just heard about him. Oh.
Yeah, I didn't talk to Bobby.
So did you
see him? Didn't know Bobby that well.
Did you see him when he was over there?
Nope.
Okay. Okay. Well, it was Vietnam.
When you and I and Linda were talking earlier, this came up. May as well stick it on the tape that I don't know about other people's experiences. I think they were like mine. You know, we were sent out to some place, and we didn't get into Saigon that often, and we didn't meet other volunteers all that often.
Unless you were, like, right there, or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my memory on this isn't very good. I may have run into Bobby one time in Saigon. I just don't recall.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I haven't refreshed my memory on that in a long time. And so it's gone, and I don't want to tell you more than I know.
Oh, yeah, no. I was just spinning on the name and the circumstance.
But, you know, that was, if anything, that was the influence. So neither of us lasted very long there. We went in different directions. And that's how I got into Vietnam. I contacted people in Washington, and they said that a fellow whose name, if I recall right, was Tom Watkins, was back. He had been in Cambodia and was driving down the coast. He could stop off in New Haven, and we had a chat, and that, I guess, was my interview.
You said earlier, a one-hour...
Yeah, it was about an hour.
Yeah,
he was driving through. He stopped off in New Haven, came over. We sat and chatted, and... nice man. I had a lot more confidence in this venture when he left, and apparently I didn't make too bad an impression because they took me in.
Mm-hmm.
To my everlasting gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great experience.
And you describe yourself as more of a generalist. Did he say...
Yeah, I didn't know anything about anything, so that made me a generalist.
I love that. Yeah, because of course I was the same thing.
Yeah, and later on the government decided to put its money on people who actually had some useful expertise. And I think that they were right, but we were lucky. They hadn't figured that out.
Yeah, yeah, it snuck under the wire.
Yeah.
Because, again, off tape, I really like this. I'm going to put it on the tape so that if I hear it again, I'll remember it. And when I was in Peace Corps, I did exactly what I was trained to do. Oh, well. So, anyway, so you hear about the organization, you're terribly interested in Vietnam because of all, you know, the roommate, the general press, I would imagine, and things going on campus, and here's your opportunity.
Yeah, and I might add, unlike people came over a few years later, it was a very different situation. At the time I went over, it corresponded to the first big troop buildup.
Mm-hmm.
But the previous spring, I remember getting into an argument in the dining hall with some guys.
About 65.
Yeah.
Okay.
That, or maybe a little earlier than that, I remember we got into an argument. And I remember saying, what do you mean we're not involved in a war? We've got 15,000 advisors there.
This is what you said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a big story in Time magazine where a couple of these guys had gotten killed and bodies mutilated in a particularly gruesome way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what caught our attention. We were arguing about whether, you know, the extent of our involvement. So this was not long after there was an argument as to whether or not we were significantly involved in this country. And at this time, anybody who went to graduate school had a draft deferment.
Still, yes.
Mm-hmm. I had to give that up. And
for IVS.
For IVS. Also had to volunteer for the draft for that.
Could you get a 2A occupational deferment?
Not in my area.
Okay. Peace Corps was getting them.
Well.
Even a little later than that.
I think there was a lot of local discretion there. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, it would be draft board by draft board.
And I know they had good relationships with General Hershey. But.
They meaning Peace Corps?
IVS did.
Okay.
I believe they did. And. Well, you've got better sources of information than that.
I haven't checked into that. So
yeah, Don would know about that because he was chief of party then. Well, what I had to do was, I take it back, was not volunteer for the draft. I had to do something that got them to run me through the physical.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of the physical, I was classified as physically unfit, 1Y.
What was 4F?
Well, there were two classifications. There was also one called 1Y. 1Y is you're not fit, but we'll look at you again in 6 months. Okay?
Uh-huh.
All right? And that speeded up things very quickly.
For you?
For me, because the draft, in order to leave the country at that time, if you were of draft age, you had to have approval of your draft board. The draft board wanted me to go through the physical. The people
mm-hmm.
who did the physical said, we wouldn't take this guy into the Army now anyway. So that made it a whole lot easier, and I got approval to leave the country. But there were people in Vietnam and Laos, IVS volunteers who would get called by their draft board. Their draft board wanted them to return to the United States and submit to the physical and send them. And that's where the connection with General Hershey came in.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe there were some cases where that happened and they went to Hershey and Hershey sent down from the top saying, now this person is doing something useful for United States interests, maintain the deferment.
Yeah.
How many cases that happened in, I don't know. But there was at least one person, I was told, who was drafted out of Vietnam.
Really?
Yeah. Which is rather ironic because the modern army's got a long tail. And the chances of your being in harm's way, if you were a randomly selected soldier in the combat zone, were, I think, much, much lower than the chances of you being in harm's way if you were a randomly selected IVS volunteer. The number of our people who were killed there was very low, as but significant as a percentage of our total
volunteers.
Of total volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was lower. It was very low compared to that of people in the service who were in combat, of course. But it was rather high compared to all those people who sat behind typewriters in air-conditioned offices in Saigon in War Army Green. And that was still a time when, you know, the college boy would be made the clerk. And so there was a certain irony there, Paul.
He's getting saved, in a sense.
Yeah.
Putting something a little bit less...
I think so.
I'll ask Don about those two things. Hershey's thing and then the possibility that somebody got drafted out of... their country of service.
I believe there was at least one case
of
that. Or, I don't... That may have been one where going to Hershey. I mean, Don would know. I'm trying to recall gossip from almost 30 years ago.
Right.
Yeah,
well, I do know one person who came home from Laos and was going to be drafted. And so volunteered for the Marines and just made that a career.
Well, when I got back from Vietnam, I got called right away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you have as much luck the second time around with your physical?
Well, actually, the first time it wasn't a matter of luck. The second time it was extraordinary luck. And
the first time it was not a matter of luck?
No, I had high blood pressure.
Oh, you really did?
Yeah, and the Army has this philosophy, we're not going to take in anybody that's got anything wrong with them, not because we're worried that they might get killed in a state other than perfect health. It's because we have this policy that we can't release them unless they're in good health.
Mm-hmm.
And if we take in somebody who's got a problem, we might have to deal with this for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
The second time it was luck, because I had all these letters from people in Vietnam saying I was sentient enough to gather them before I left, saying this young man is going back to do graduate school in economics, graduate work in economics, and his plan is to come back to Vietnam and work in economic development. When the war is over, and this is going to be of great service to the interests of the United States. He has already spent 2.5 years here. He's been exposed to danger with some frequency. He's been very helpful to us. Leave him the hell alone so we can get him back here.
And have him do some good.
Yeah, in good order. And by the time I got home, what I found out was that my local draft board was now under such pressure to come up with
bodies
that, as a clerk explained to me, well, look, young man, you've had your fun, you've had your vacation. you're going to have to serve your country too. And I could see that point of view. And so I got called for the physical, and the second time I went through it, where the luck came up was at the very end comes the point where they interview you.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you sit down on the metal folding chair and warm it up a bit with your body while they go over this long government form in which you've had to indicate every disease or condition that you've ever had in your life.
But you had a few buttes on there.
Yeah. You see the direction that we're going here. And
how many times have you had malaria?
Yeah, this physician was looking at dengue fever and all these other diseases. Where the hell have you been? They said, Vietnam. And
you're really good money flipping through the pages. Yeah. That you made the big bucks when you were there as a civilian.
Oh yeah, because civilians were making
they
big
were
bucks.
Yeah, and they would have a lot of resentment from the military.
Yep, especially some guy who, after going through medical school and residency, was about to make the big bucks himself and got called.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's why he's doing physicals. Okay, and getting paid army pay.
Mm-hmm.
Which as a captain doctor was better than as a PFC, but it wasn't like being a civilian physician.
No. Especially in a hazardous duty area where the Army is paying you bigger bucks.
Well, and he wasn't hazardous duty. This is at the Minneapolis Armory.
That's right.
This guy's
got
nothing.
Right?
So all these years...
Paper cuts.
Studied, yeah. The guy studied to be a doctor, and now he's interviewing some little snot who has been making more money than he is. And the guy said, big money. I said, 80 bucks a month. And that stopped him. He said, what the hell were you doing? And so I explained, and he kept wanting more details. Meanwhile, behind me, there's a long line of young men shivering in their underwear, waiting for this.
He doesn't give a damn.
Well, I didn't give a damn, because I thought, this guy wants to know, he's controlling my destiny. I'll tell him anything he wants.
Absolutely.
And after a while, he said, excuse me, I must consult with my colleagues. And he came back after a while and he said, we find you 1Y, which means we'll call you for examination in 6 months. How old will you be then? And I said, 26. And he said, okay, because that was... They were calling people up to age 26. And so, in effect, he unilaterally deferred me and...
Long enough for the birthday to kick in.
Wrote hypertension over the form. They hadn't gotten to the point where they took my blood pressure yet, but... And I thought to myself, well, this is interesting. If I had had long hair or dark skin, I would now... be on my way to sitting behind a typewriter in an air-conditioned office because I wasn't fit for combat. But this fellow, basically what he did is he got together with the other guys and he said, let's let the son of a bitch through. He wasn't going to do it on his own authority. They all said, fine, 2.5 years is enough. Right? And
yeah,
I was impressed with the basic justice of the system.
Or at least of that human being.
Yeah. Well, I'm speaking with some sarcasm. He shouldn't have had the authority to play God like that, but I didn't feel like making a big protest.
No, this is not
time for an ethical discussion.
No. No. This is
so.
Yeah, this is something you just accept.
Yeah.
Anyway, we can get back to the beginning of the story rather than at the end. But that's a good story. I haven't got anything like that for any of my physicals.
Well, I hope that some of the other aspects of this physical you've avoided too, but we don't have to go into that.
No, I had a... I'm going to pause the tape here.
Having a good time on that coffee prep break. Where were we, actually? We were just getting you into IBS,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah.
Could you go on to the little bit of Harper's Ferry sort of prep and flight over and language training and such?
Sure. We were all quartered in an old hotel that was in Washington, a little north of the Lincoln Memorial and west of the White House. And I'm trying to remember the name of it, and I can't.
Oh, some other people
Lee
have been
Hotel
there.
Or something like that.
I think it may be.
Yeah. And it was about two blocks away from an old house that I had lived in the two summers previous to that, with a bunch of other people who were in Washington who had come down to be interns. I was an intern in the Trade Negotiations Agency, which at that time had 11 people, all of whom worked in the executive office building, so I knew the neighborhood well. And I thought, you know, I would never live in such a decrepit place again.
Well, there you were.
And there I was, yeah. Except this really was a step up.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to walk across the bridge to someplace in Virginia for language lessons.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was in Virginia, because I remember this is a long bridge. And Foreign Service Institute language lessons, and a nice lady from Vietnam drilled us in tones and basic words. And I do mean drill, because this was the summer of 1960. No, it was not the summer. It was the spring. Late winter, early spring of 1966. So that is more than 30 years ago.
Uh-huh. Slightly.
Toifaidilai Hakchan Majestic. I have to go to the Majestic Hotel. I remember the drill from that. They put us through it so many times. And, you know, the Majestic Hotel was the first thing I wanted to see when I got to Saigon.
No kidding. At least you could find it.
It was a great, yeah, right. It was Adan Kiekia. I remember that. It was somewhat of a disappointment after all that build-up. But,
well, of course it had to be. Even the Luxor in Las Vegas wouldn't be.
But as I look back on it, that was a terribly valuable part of the training, and I just wish we had gotten more of it, because we got 6 weeks of a couple hours a day.
After, when you got there?
No, this was in Washington.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And as I look back on it, my Vietnamese was never all that good. And it would have been better had we gotten a little more language training up to the point where we could really take off. I learned Vietnamese to the extent that I learned it from children. I would sit and play elephant chess with children.
Uh-huh.
And about the time I was getting good enough so I could play with their older brothers, my vocabulary could move up a bit.
Yeah.
And eventually I was able to play with some of the school teachers, which I regarded as a great accomplishment. Of course, the only school teachers I could play with were the ones who were the Zhaoshu, the professor of French literature, because they couldn't play any better than a kid.
But that's okay. You were after it for language.
But, well, there, I remember there was one teacher at the school where I worked who liked to make fun of the American in my attempts to learn Vietnamese. And one time we sat and played a game of chess.
Mm-hmm.
And I beat him.
Ah.
And I look back on it and I realize I shouldn't have. But he had me really pissed. And this was a humiliation. He didn't show up at the school for days. He had lost to a foreigner.
Well, he was the one who was making all the jokes.
This is true.
I mean, it does come around. I have, well.
Well, I must admit, I was not entirely my own agent here. There was a very nice man in the neighborhood I met, of whom I have wonderful memories. His name was Mr. Bao. Mr. Bao was an older man. He had been a secretary in the imperial government under Bao Dai. And he was a man of great learning.
Mm-hmm.
And he invited me into his home, and I noticed he had a bookcase, glassed-in bookcase. He had operated his own school for a while. There are a lot of private schools in Vietnam. And he had made a connection with the good ladies of Darien, Connecticut, who would collect books and send them to the benighted third world people. And he had all these books he had gotten all these books that were being discarded by people in Darien. He had quite a library. And once when a friend of his came over, I just occupied myself with looking at the books. And when his friend left, I said, I see you've got Hugh Trevor Roper's Last Days of Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had a chance to read it?
Uh-huh.
And he said, oh yes, it's quite good, but the French version is actually better. Right? And he knew Chinese. He was a very educated man.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go there every Saturday, and he would teach me to play chess. This was a secret project, because at the school, since he was not a graduate of the Faculty of Pedagogy in Saigon, he was regarded as like what we would call an adjunct.
Uh-huh.
And he was not treated very well, and he did not receive the respect that he should have had. His revenge was he taught me to play elephant chess, and the day I beat the French teacher was his triumph.
Yes. Good.
But my Vietnamese would have gotten a whole lot better if, because I'm not good at languages, if I had had a bit more of that head start, because those people were good.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I look back on it, it was so much easier to pick up from that point after having just I think it was 6 weeks of a couple hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
Another footnote, excuse me for wandering. But
oh, no, some of this is very, very good.
The group that I went with.
Yes, I would ask you about them.
Had two people in it, and it had a lot of good people. It's a small group. I remember them all with great fondness, but there were two people who were exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've heard both their names. One is Dave Gittleson, and the other was Fred Scheidler.
Mm-hmm. Who went to Laos.
Laos, and was killed in Laos.
Yes.
Direct
assassination, just like Gittleson.
That's right. And except that I think that Fred was, I don't know, maybe you know more about this, but from what I've heard, Fred was killed by Pathet Lao people. Gittleson, I don't think it's really known, but it probably wasn't the people we called the enemy. It was probably the people we called our friends, or maybe it was we.
Yes, in a very direct sense.
Yes.
I doubt very much that it was Viet Cong.
Wonderful people. Fred was a pacifist, a Tolstoyan, a stonecutter. He had the biggest arms, the biggest forearms on any young man I'd ever seen. And, you know, when you want to see strong, rock-hard forearms, usually you're talking about an older guy, because every time you wiggle your fingers, you're moving these muscles. They never get a chance to build up the way weightlifters build up other muscles. It's usually somebody who's been working on construction for a long time. Fred was a stone cutter, a man who's just his physical presence told you this is strength.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Gentle, kind. And a very special person. And it was an unusual group. We had one guy, Beryl, and his last name just flew out of my mind. A nice man who'd been a sergeant in the Army in Vietnam and now was going back with IVS.
Beryl?
Yeah. And I can't remember his last name.
Oh, that's the first name. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just stuck. And you had Dave Gittleson, who was on the Vietnam Day Committee at Berkeley, who was studying soil science at Davis and went over as an ag man, a city boy. Okay? And we all got along. And these two guys were roommates.
Mm.
Both very special people, and both killed, tragically for the rest of us, because they really were special, and you know, Lord knows how much they would have continued contributing. Dave was in language training with us, and there were, you know, a handful of us, four or five of us, who were headed to Vietnam. The others were headed to Laos. Dave Gittleson was a constant source of frustration to the lady who was teaching us because Dave had trouble with tones.
Oh, no.
Dave couldn't do the tones. Maybe he was tone deaf.
Mm-hmm.
Dave, for Dave, language training was a complete disaster as far as the teacher was concerned. Dave, more than anybody else who went over there as a volunteer, was able to communicate. Dave was the guy who became fluent by sheer exertion of will. Just a remarkable person.
Uh-huh.
Really remarkable. I mean, I indicated earlier when we were talking before that this was a The time I spent in IVS was the best experience of my life.
Yeah.
One of the reasons for that, I mean, despite all the sadness and all the insanity, and despite losing some people that I was very close to, including a fellow who became my best friend when I was there and with whom I was sharing a place, who got killed in one of our Air Force's mistakes.
Who was that, IVS?
No, his name was Nguyen Van Hien. Despite all of that, and his story, by the way, is worth a book. Despite all that, it was the best time of my life because, as I indicated earlier, just by, you know, being there, I can drive the car and get you through the police lines. I can let you do your work.
You can play that middleman role to open up doors because
that's right.
Simply because you're an American with a white face who can
exactly. To no great credit, or no credit at all, on my part, just as being the facilitator, which anybody could do who was an American, had a white face, and yet it really had to be white.
Yeah. Yeah, it couldn't have been
at that
white
time. That's right. A lot of good was done and a lot of bad was avoided that otherwise wouldn't have been. And so that 2.5 years is extremely productive, and as I indicated earlier, that's why I stayed behind when other people came home. I was still able to do that where I was, and when I couldn't anymore, then I left.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, the beginning of another academic year was looming and I was going to head back to graduate school, I had to make a choice. Do I go now or do I stay here another year?
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, couldn't do anything anymore. Place had become overrun by American officialdom.
Uh-huh.
There was that factor and the fact that I met so many wonderful people of whom I have great memories. American people and Vietnamese people. And I met a lot of nice people since, but it's not been like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could stay here a week, I could just tell you stories about people I met, wonderful people I met. It was a great experience.
Yeah.
So we had that language training. There was one time we went to Harper's Ferry. You asked about Harper's Ferry. And people spoke to us, and we played a game called the development game, and we did some other stuff. And I think it was probably useful
the
because...
The development game.
Yeah, you don't know about the development
game?
No. Somebody had come up with this board game.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and you'd sit around in a group and move markers and decide to do this or decide to do that. And I don't know what the value of all this was, but we did get to meet each other. We also got to hear some talks that were given to us by the State Department, or people connected with the State Department. As I look back on it, I'm just astonished that... I'm astonished that even then, when so much was at stake, we would have people who would speak to us as experts about whom we found out in a few months they didn't know shit from Shinola.
Uh-huh.
Although, as George Carlin says, you can imagine how the Shinola people feel about that one. I mean, because, you know, here I was a good little grad student type, and I used to go to these
taking
things.
Down these notes.
Taking notes, yeah, because... if I take notes, I'm going to remember, and you know, a whole lecture on the only way to understand Vietnamese culture is because you have to understand they are Taoists. And I got to Vietnam, and in 2.5 years, I didn't meet a Taoist. You know, it was very strange. but I think the language training was
really
very
good.
Helpful.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And then our group arrived in Saigon on, I believe, the 7th of April, 1966.
Mm. It's very, very precise.
The date sticks in my mind, and I wouldn't vouch for it because that's 30 years ago plus.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was April 7th.
Okay.
And we spent a little time in Saigon. And then Bob Walker and I were sent up to Fontiet, where we met Dave Rock,
mm-hmm.
who had rented a house,
mm-hmm.
was living there, and the three of us lived there for a while. Bob eventually relocated up north. Dave went back home, and I was alone in Fontiet.
Bob Walker is in Des Moines.
Really?
Yeah.
Got an address for him?
I'll write it down.
Great. I'll give you a sheet of paper.
I got a sheet here.
Oh, okay.
Don't worry about it. He didn't respond to our thing, so... anyway. Who was all in your group? I mean, you've already mentioned Scheidler, and you mentioned Gettleson. And,
yeah, Scheidler was in the Laos portion. And, you know, now I'm feeling embarrassed because I see all these faces before me,
mm-hmm.
and I'm beginning to blank on names.
Okay.
I can remember parts of names, not whole names.
Oh, excuse me. That just grabbed me.
Boy, this is embarrassing. I can't remember John's last name. He came from Detroit. There was Bruce and Beryl, Dave, and I. Vietnam, there was the Reynolds. I think they later married.
Uh-huh.
We're going to Laos. There was the Earharts, as I recall. They're going to Laos. I'm going to think of each and every one of these names along about 2 o'clock this morning.
Well, you have my email address. If you say, damn it, he asked, I'm going to send it. You could send it.
Yeah, thanks for this address. I had to get in touch with him because...
And if there are others, we can, if I have them, I'll, share.
Yeah, this Vietnam alumni group that put out an address list a little while ago, God mm-hmm. bless those folks, because...
Oh, the IBS book of alumni?
Yeah.
Thing? Yeah, they're making up another one.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that, because I just lost track.
Yeah.
I was sort of out of touch with a lot of people for a long time.
That happens many times. I mean, I've done the same sort of thing at different times. So anyway, we got you in Saigon. Of course, some branch off to Laos, and then did you immediately go from there into an assignment?
We were there for a short period of time.
Okay.
And it wasn't very long, and then Bob and I went up to Phan-Tia.
With Ronk and all
yeah.
that. Okay. I know that a lot of probably the best stuff that you could say is away from your actual job description. But for the purposes of just spitting it out now, what was the actual job that you were assigned to do?
I was supposed to teach English
mm-hmm.
in the local schools, and...
Because you had more than one school in your yellow sheet.
Well, the public high school, middle, what we'd call a middle school
mm-hmm.
and senior high school, corresponding to our about 6th grade up to our 12th grade.
Mm-hmm.
Each and every one of which grades was about 4 years ahead of what ours did then, and so that would be like 8 years ahead of what ours do now.
Yeah.
The public high school was called Phan Boi Cho, and that's where I was supposed
Important
to be.
Important name.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, you're a historian. You recognize that name. And there was a semi-public school across the street from it.
Semi-public?
Semi-public is what they call it.
They train semi-drivers or something?
I never understood this distinction. The main distinction was that the civil servant graduates of the Saigon Faculty of Pedagogy
mm-hmm.
who were going to teach in public schools as professors for a minimum of 10 years, they were at Phan Boi Cho.
Mm-hmm.
The people who worked the semi-public school did not have those credentials, except occasionally they were moonlighting from the public school.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Catholic school
mm-hmm.
and a Buddhist school, which of course was named Bodhi, the Bo Tree. And I worked in all of those schools, and it was an entree to the community
mm-hmm.
because if you knew if you had some kind of connection, you were able to do various things. I was able to be of some help later on to the people at the pagoda, who took in an amazing number of refugees because of my connection with a man there who was studying English from me was running that school. Who would be worth a chapter in a book, as would the priest who ran the Catholic school. Here in the middle of nowhere in Fontiette was a man who was a graduate of the, I forget the name, it's flown out of my mind, you recognize the name in Rome, where he had acquired English because he met many other fellow priests at the North American College. Just an extraordinarily educated man. If I were a writer, I would have turned out at least one book just about some of these wonderful and wonderfully interesting people that I met. So that was the entree, and eventually I was able to get involved in other things. Part of it, a lot of it was thrust upon me when the Tet Offensive came, but there were little projects. Like, it turned out there was some guy in the province, an older man, who had developed a substance. I guess the technical name for it would be a stick'em that you would smear on things, and it attracted flies.
Important.
Right. This was fantastic fly paper, and he was trying to get the government interested in this. And I tried to get AID to back it. It would have made a wonderful project. As far as we got was, at one point, there was a big parade in Fontiette of school children who were organized to march with signs saying, "Death to the fly, enemy of humanity."
Very good.
And we did. We set up demonstration projects and so on. And Paul, this is amazing. I don't know how this guy came up with this stuff, and he refused to tell anybody. Of course.
Of course. Right? Of course, I would never tell.
But my God, all he wanted was to make a few bucks on it, which would have been trivial compared to what AID was spending.
Yeah.
And this stuff was magic. You set it around in the hospital. Suddenly, there were no flies around. There were all sorts of little things like that. But I was able to go into offices and talk to people because I had been a professor in the school.
Yeah.
That's...